from Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at the National Journal, and here are the issues. A new ceasefire agreement in Ukraine was reached by the leaders of France and Germany with Russian President Vladimir Putin. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said it offered, quote, a glimmer of hope, no more and no less, unquote. In Washington, President Obama asked Congress to authorize the use of military force with limits against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Also in Washington, Congress sent the White House legislation approving construction of the Keystone Pipeline to carry oil from Canada to American refineries. And President Obama has said he will veto that measure. Talks on a nuclear deal with Iran continued with a deadline at the end of March for a framework of an agreement. Well, let's start with this ceasefire agreement. Tom, they have an agreement, and yet I've never heard such pessimism about whether it will work, even for a few days.
Well, there's a pretty valid reason for that, Fred, and that is the previous agreement hammered out in Minsk a few months ago with Putin and the Russians has been totally ignored. Everything that the Russians were supposed to do and not do, they've done and not done in that one. So it's hard to get particularly excited about a new deal when the Russians didn't abide by the old deal. Now, a glimmer of hope, I think, is the right construction here. There's supposed to be a ceasefire. There's supposed to be a pullback. There's supposed to be more autonomy for the parts of Ukraine that are more or less Russian sympathizers. But Putin, I think, has figured out he can sign anything and agree to anything, and he can ignore anything, and he can get away with it. We'll see. Now, I suspect that this time, if he walks away from this deal, there could well be sanctions. But it's hard to see at the moment how he comes out weaker as a result of this. And again, he doesn't have a history of doing what he says he's going to do, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, Barbara, is there a pattern here where... Yes, there is a pattern. I'll try and describe what I think the pattern is. And that is that the rebels in eastern Ukraine, with help from Russia in weapons and soldiers who may not be dressed as Russian soldiers, they make some gains. Then they have a deal, and they consolidate those gains. And then the deal breaks down, and then they have another deal that consolidates the further gains.
It's like island hopping in the Pacific in World War II.
I think that's very well put. I mean... You know, and Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, has the satisfaction of keeping the leaders of the free world up all night to hammer out these agreements. I think the catalyst this time, yes, partly they wanted to consolidate their gains, but also the U.S. is threatening to send, quote-unquote, defensive weapons to the Ukrainian military, and that would have resulted in perhaps more Russian casualties, since there are 8,000-9,000 Russian soldiers, at least as far as we know, wandering around in eastern Ukraine. And so that might have increased the cost to Putin. And I think that threat is still on the table. Also, the sanctions Tom mentioned, there are sanctions which are damaging, and those remain in place while the world, you know, watches to see if this agreement is implemented. So we'll know soon enough. They're supposed to have a ceasefire. They're supposed to withdraw their heavy weapons. You know, we'll see if they actually do that. And any respite for the people of eastern Ukraine is probably welcome at this stage. But no, I would not trust Vladimir Putin as far as I could throw him, which is not very far.
I guess it's not. Tom, the agreement here, it doesn't seem to do much to help Ukraine at all. They seem to have given up more land again. I think it's something like 200 square miles in eastern Ukraine. When will this stop?
I think it will only stop, to be blunt about it, as if the economic crisis in Russia gets worse. I mean, as we all know, the Russian economy is almost exclusively centered on oil revenues, and the price of a barrel of oil has plunged in the last several months. Some analysts think it's bottoming out, and it's I notice in the United States prices at the gas pump are slightly higher than they were a month ago. Others say, no, the price per barrel of oil is going to go down some more. So, and if that happens, then Putin's economic pressures will be heightened. I mean, I just suspect that it's going to be more of the same. You get the feeling that Putin has decided that he can thumb his nose at the West. It's very clear that President Obama, who is still traumatized, is far too strong a word, but he is profoundly affected by the Iraq war and the Afghan war, and he doesn't want to get into another one of those. We'll come to that, I'm sure, shortly. But I don't think he wanted to send even what he called lethal defensive weapons only, because lethal defensive weapons kill people. And he agreed to wait one more time before making that decision to see how this deal happened, if it happened. Well, it happened, but let's see how it works. I think he's very reluctant. I think Putin senses that reluctance and has taken advantage of it. So we will see. But the president's still got to make some tough decisions. But I think at this point, the next move is Mr. Putin's.
Yeah, Tom, it wasn't just President Obama's reluctance, but the European leaders, Germany, so on, France, Britain, they're reluctant to have more weapons sent in because they know that, look, Russia is militarily more powerful. So, you know, Ukraine can try to defend itself, but it's very difficult. The decision is Putin's. How much does he want to bite off? How much does he think he can get away with? Most of the analysts that I've been reading say he wants this as another so-called frozen conflict, something that will prevent the entry of Ukraine into NATO, which wasn't, frankly, likely anyway. But Putin is paranoid about that. And as long as this war is going on in eastern Ukraine, there's no chance that that NATO would absorb Ukraine.
Is it true, as folks have written, that Putin is just more determined about what he's doing than Germany, France, the United States are determined to stop him?
Yeah, well,
maybe determined's not the right
word.
We
have to, I mean, let's be honest, this is not, you know, black and white. There are people in eastern Ukraine who want to have that close relationship with Russia. There are a lot of Russians living in Ukraine, and the country really is divided between those who identify more with Kiev and those who identify more with Moscow. So, I mean, he is partly responding to the genuine desire of a significant group of people in eastern Ukraine who want these ties with Russia. But he's also, this is the only way Russia can be important anymore. I mean, through its control over Russian speakers, through its control over former Soviet territories, you know, it has nuclear weapons and it has this influence over the former Soviet Union. And, you know, oil was the third leg of the stool, and that's not worth as much anymore.
You mentioned about Russians being in these independent countries that were once a part of the Soviet Union and Russia, and we have the same problem in the Baltic states. The Baltic countries correct me if I'm wrong, were colonized with Russians by Stalin.
Yeah, but the Baltic states are part of NATO. So, no, I think Putin, you know, he's not insane. He's not going to challenge these countries that are part of NATO now. And that had a, you know, a real history of independence before the Soviet Union or certainly during the interregnum between World War I and II. He's on much safer ground with countries like Ukraine and Georgia and Moldova that are, you know, a lot weaker.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure we'll be talking about this again. We'll see if there is a glimmer of hope, as the German chancellor said. Well, President Obama sent to Congress this to get authorization the use of military force, which is already being used, of course, in Syria and Iraq, against ISIS, this powerful, I think, sort of a consolidation of terrorist groups. In the first place, why does he need this authorization, Tom? I mean, he can claim, and he has claimed, constitutional authority for the president, which I think he has. And then you have the authorization of the use of force going back to 9/11 or after 9/11.
Right. I mean, there's no doubt, or most constitutional scholars say there's no doubt that the president already has the authority to do what he's asking Congress to let him do. So it raises the obvious question, which you have raised. I think there are a couple of answers. I should also say in a town that is acronym crazy, this is a new one, AUMF, authorize use of military force. I think part of it is to show that the president is not what Richard Nixon once called in another context a pitiful, helpless giant. That mm-hmm. the drubbing his party took last November in the elections, the loss of the Senate to the Republicans, has not rendered President Obama as impotent as Republicans would like to believe. He is still the primary officer of American foreign policy, and this is a way to show that he's leading. He's had real problems with perceptions of poor leadership, and I think that there is a political component, and that is it. I think the other piece of this is also grounded in some politics. As I said earlier, he's been profoundly affected by Afghanistan and Iraq, and he has resisted time and again when advisors have said, well, we need another 20,000 troops here or there. And he wanted to make another point of saying he's not going to get us into another land war in the Middle East. That's why this authority he's asking for is only for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So he will lock in the next president, at least at the outset of the next term of the next president. But he's very reluctant to do anything that suggests there would be open-ended military authority. And, of course, I guess there's a third reason. He wants Congress on board. He wants the Republicans mm-hmm. to be on board supporting what will probably be more substantial military action. Mm-hmm. But this order, the request, the AUMF, has some curious language, but it talks about this does not approve an enduring military operation. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't define what enduring meant. I think what it really means is no divisions of army troops on the ground in Syria and Iraq. But there's no question there will be more American soldiers in Syria and Iraq, but not, what was his phrase, long-term, large-scale combat mm-hmm. operations are not what he has in mind. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, what about this? I mean, I think there's already erupted in Congress a pretty robust debate among some Democrats who don't want it at all and Republicans who think there are the limitations on the use of yeah. force in this authorization are too great.
Yeah, it doesn't look like its prospects are very good, frankly, mm-hmm. because of exactly what you said. I mean, he's trying to get the sort of Goldilocks, not too hot, you know, not too cold, just right solution to this. And that upsets Republicans who think he should have more authority. Or a future president should have more authority, and Democrats who think this already gives him too much authority. There's also the question of why he's bothering to do it. I mm-hmm. mean, you know, we already have now 2,600 U.S. troops in Iraq, which allegedly do not have a combat mission. But, you know, their advisory role, I think, is getting perilously close to that in some cases. And there are two authorizations, two AUMFs, one in 2001 that authorized the war in Afghanistan, which remains in effect, would not be changed by this new one. The one that would be repealed would be the 2002 one, which authorized the invasion of Iraq, which, of course, President Obama opposed. But, you know, he still has the power to send special forces anywhere he wants, to use drones to kill people. This new authorization would allow limited ground actions such as rescue operations or the use of special operations forces to take military action against the leadership of the Islamic State. Also would allow the use of ground forces for intelligence gathering, spotting ground targets for airstrikes, and planning assistance to the ground troops of allies. So, you know, maybe the specificity is kind of nice in a way for some, but these are powers that the president has already been using extensively in the fight that we've had already against the Islamic State.
Well, I'm going to ask a couple
And against
more...
the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
Indeed. I'm going to ask a couple more questions on this. But first, we're going to take a break. And this is a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues-in-the-news. Tom, is the military, the Pentagon, the admirals and the generals and so on, well, not so much the admirals here, but particularly the generals, is this what they want? Usually, well, I'll just leave it at that. Are they going to be satisfied with this, unhappy with this?
Well, I think they would like a further codification of the authority to do mm-hmm. things that the military thinks that are necessary. I mean, this is a parallel situation, but the commander of U.S. forces in the region, General John Campbell, is already on record in testimony on Capitol Hill that he would like the authority to be far more flexible in Afghanistan about what American troops can or cannot do there, because it's very clear that there are going to have to be some adjustments. Well, let me put it this way. The Pentagon leaders, including the new Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, believe that there will have to be some modifications to the Obama timetable of having every American soldier out of Afghanistan by 2017 when he leaves office, and that the military wants the flexibility to do more or less, and given the situation on the ground, and everybody realizes and believes that the Pentagon's going to need to do more in the next 2 years. So the military doesn't want to be shackled, but the military is also subject to civilian control. They understand that. So I think all things considered, the Pentagon is fine with this because it gives them more authority to have more flexibility. On the other hand, the commander-in-chief makes that final decision, and that's President Obama. But it's mm-hmm. pretty clear that the rosy scenario of an easy reduction in American troops in Afghanistan is not as easy and predictable mm-hmm. as the original timetable, and I suspect it will be the same for Iraq and Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the moment, just to finish this, Barbara, it looks like there is basically a stalemate there. ISIS has not been driven back much, but a little bit. And the president has said, quite frankly, that this is not going to be a quick victory if there is one.
Yeah, well, what we're waiting for in Iraq is to see whether it's going to be possible to retake the city of Mosul, mm-hmm. the second largest city in Iraq.
Right.
For that, there need to be Sunni Iraqis, mm-hmm. Sunni Muslim Iraqis, mm-hmm. who are willing to risk their lives. The problem now is that the main boots on the ground, apart from those Americans that I mentioned, are Peshmerga, the Kurds, who cannot really go and liberate Mosul, mm-hmm. and Iraqi Shiite militias supported by Iran, who would be very ill-advised to go into a city like Mosul. So that's what everyone's waiting for, to see whether it's going to be possible to create some Sunni Muslim forces with some real skin in the game. And to some extent, that's also true in Syria. The elusive Syrian moderates, the moderate forces that are supposed to be trained up, those have yet to appear.
Okay, let's turn briefly to the Keystone Pipeline, which has been an issue here in the United States for how long now, at least for the entirety of the Obama presidency. And the pipeline would bring oil or crude oil from northern Alberta in Canada down to refineries on the Gulf Coast, the Gulf of Mexico coast. And this has become a very sensitive issue to particularly the two groups. One are environmentalists in the United States, and the other is the Canadian government, which has been, one of the most important things for a prime minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, is getting along with the American president. And yet this has become sort of a difficulty for them. Tom?
Well, this is a real source of friction between the U.S. and its neighbor to the north, who, I guess, since the War of 1812 have mm-hmm. have enjoyed really close relations, but the Canadians absolutely want this pipeline built. And the president, I don't know how many more ways the president could say that he's opposed to this. He said it will create a few jobs in construction, mm-hmm. but they'll be temporary jobs. He says the oil that will be refined on the Gulf Coast of the U.S. will then be shipped around the world, so there's no value to U.S. consumers. And as you've said, he's talked about the environmental concerns time and time again. The bottom line is the president has flatly said he will veto it. I don't believe there are enough votes in Congress to overturn that veto.
No, there aren't.
So, I think this is a done deal. Some cynics would say, well, the president's just preserving executive authority, and ultimately the State Department, which has to weigh in on this and has been very slowly mm-hmm. to a fault assessing the situation. Some cynics will say, well, they'll kick in and say, well, it's not so bad. We'll mm-hmm. do this. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've said that before, but there's always another. Then they have another study. You know, the Canadians say, well, look, this oil, if we don't send it through the U.S., we'll send it to the West Coast, and it'll go to China or something. So the environmentalists who do want to stop this pipeline from being built, I mean, that would seem to undermine their cause, because the oil's going to get into the global oil market one way or another.
the greenhouse gas emissions that come from tar sands, this is really filthy stuff, by the way, would come out whether it's shipped, you know, down through the United States or it goes out some other way. I think the hope is, frankly, that this will slow the development of these tar sands now that the price of oil is somewhat down. The, you know, this kind of oil is less attractive than it was a few years ago when oil was selling for over $100 a barrel. But, I mean, to me, it's just, you know, here we are. Congress is once again, you know, it's just making these futile gestures. President Obama's going to veto it. Meanwhile.
Well, this is the first time it's gotten to his desk.
Yeah.
It's been blocked before.
But, you know, meanwhile, the Congress can't even fund the Department of Homeland Security. And another deadline is approaching for that. So it's just another sign, to my mind, of congressional dysfunction. I don't think the Republicans should be patting themselves on the back because they managed to pass the thing.
No, well, they probably shouldn't because it's they didn't have the vote in the House, by the way, as you suggested, Tom, was 270 to 152. It takes two-thirds of both the House and the Senate to override a veto, and they clearly don't have the votes in the Senate, but it's clear from the numbers in the House they don't have that either. Barbara, we were talking about deadlines. The deadline for funding the Department of Homeland Security is February 27th, but there's an end-of-March deadline on the talks with the Iranians, and what is it?
P5 plus one, yeah. U.S., the other permanent members of the U.N. Security Council plus Germany.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a kind of a soft deadline. There's an interim nuclear agreement that was extended until the end of June, but my sense from talking to people in the last few days is that there is a very great determination now on both the Iranian side and the side of the P5 plus one to get this framework agreement done by the end of March. And there are a couple of reasons. Congress is threatening new sanctions. There's also some opposition in Iran to the deal that's shaping up. But the biggest indication, I think, that they're very, very close to an agreement is that the Prime Minister of Israel is lying across the railroad tracks to stop this train from going down to the station. The intense opposition of Netanyahu, who is coming to the United States to give a speech that is frankly going to be very controversial.
Well, I would say he's scheduled to come.
Yeah, scheduled to come, suggests that the sides are very close. And I know that there are some formulas. My colleague Laura Rosen at Al Monitor has written about some new formulas for solving the problem over uranium enrichment, how that would be limited in such a way that Iran could not break out and develop enough material for a nuclear weapon in a year without detection and the ability of the international community to do something about it. And it seems that there are compromises on the other issues as well that are coming into place. Earlier this week, just a few days ago, the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, gave a very interesting speech where he basically said that he echoed President Obama. He said he wasn't for any agreement. He wanted a, you know, if it was a bad agreement, he didn't want it. But he also said that an agreement requires compromise. Both sides have to make concessions. And he referred to Iran's acceptance in 1988 of a ceasefire in the Iran-Iraq War. This is when Ayatollah Khomeini, the leader of the revolution, quote unquote, drank the poison and agreed to a ceasefire that left Saddam Hussein in place. This is the key precedent. When you talk about 1988, it means you're ready to make concessions and reach a deal.
Ah, boy, I'm glad you follow this so closely. I don't follow the Supreme Leader's speeches, I'll have to say.
Let me tell you,
but I know they're important.
They're very important because usually he's very opaque.
Yeah.
And he's very on the one hand, on the other, and there are lots of comments that are hostile to the United States. And this speech had that too. But Iranians who follow it even more closely than I do said there was more positive than negative in the speech this time in regard to an agreement. And that's a key signal. He's preparing his base for a deal.
Tom, the one issue that, well, there are a lot of issues that remained in Congress on this, but one is Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee has a bill that would require the president to send this treaty, whatever the agreement is with Iran, to Congress for...
It's not a treaty.
It's approval. It's not a treaty. If it were a treaty, it would have to go. But anyway, I guess the president could veto this, too, if it passes. It could be sent there. But should it or shouldn't be sent to? I mean, it's a big deal.
Well, it is a big deal, and there probably ought to be, at the very least, a sense of the Senate resolution. Corker wants it to be considered a treaty, and it's a, if an agreement is done, it's a treaty in name,
right,
all but name only. But the president, I think, because of a variety of reasons, including the wish to maintain executive powers, would oppose that. I'm sure. I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether Corker has the votes to get that through the Senate.
Well, indeed, we'll see. And then the president could always veto it anyway.
Right.
It will be an issue. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for Al Monitor and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.